Hey, this is Kevin Mahoney from Raging Chicken Press.
And this is Colleen Fitzgerald from A Home Stony Run.
And this is Free Range, a place where we talk about food and politics and communities of resistance. Right? So this is our inaugural podcast. This is a long time coming, Colleen.
This is.
I'm so excited.
Right? We've talked about it for like 2 years.
Yeah, no, exactly. And everyone should know that, of course, as an inaugural podcast, of course, we spent about 2.5 hours dealing with like audio connection issues.
Get them worked out before. Get the bugs worked out before.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Whatever. So so there we have it. So, you know, on today's show, what are we talking about today, Colleen?
We are talking about community and community as a space to be vulnerable, and with that, the space to be creative.
Yeah, and I thought that kind of made a whole lot of sense of a good place to begin, kind of set the tone for. If you listen to our promo, that's one of the kind of frames, I guess, of kind of how we think about stuff in terms of. Looking at community as this space for creativity and also, you know, kind of creative dissent, right? And just kind of what we're after.
Exactly. And that's, I think, in this age of consumerism, that creativity becomes dissent because you're not just a passive consumer, but you're an active creator.
And there you have it. So, you know, if you to give everybody a sense, we'll give a little bit overview. This is kind of how the show, at least as with plans right now, is that we've got kind of a few topics that'll start us off on. And like today, for example, ideas, talk a little about the farm bill, because it's kind of like one of those spaces where kind of policy meets everyday locality, intersected with class issues, intersected with kind of race and urban rural stuff. There's a whole lot of stuff going on there. So that's kind of a cool place to begin. Plus, there's a lot going on with it right now. And then to talk a little bit about, we're going to break and have a second segment, and then we'll kind of talk a little about small-scale farming, maybe urban agriculture, some cool sites that Colleen has been kind of checking out. I have to say, I've like, I never heard of some of these things, and I'm like, whoa, this stuff is awesome. And then we're going to start with our first inaugural farm preview, where Colleen's going to give us a little bit of a preview of some of the farms that she's been working with and some of the people behind those communities. So pretty cool stuff.
Woot, woot.
So, yeah, so right at the top again here, community, right? And, you know, that's one of these words that gets batted around, you know, like everywhere from, you know, today we don't envision ourselves as a, you know, multi-billion dollar corporation designed to crush communities. We ourselves are a community, right?
With a specific culture that's linked to that corporate identity, which right. is weird. And I think that we need to expand the notion of community beyond tribal boundaries, which is what we have right now. We're small markets, you know, niches and all that kind of stuff, and we're broken down and we're broken apart. But tribalism doesn't work.
No.
So the position, like the story that we have to tell of community now is how we bring each other together and how it becomes more expansive and more inclusive and not, you know, Jordache jeans versus Levi's or something.
What's wrong with that?
To break it down into a micro school.
Come on. I want sparkles. And that person doesn't want sparkles. What's wrong with that?
Bedazzle it.
Bedazzle it. Exactly. No, it's funny when, you know, we were talking about when we're, you know, recording stuff and batting stuff back and forth and kind of recorded our promo. And you first were talking about communities of resistance. I couldn't help but think about the way that I think about solidarity, right? And solidarity as opposed to this, you know, kind of tribalism or this kind of uncritical community where everybody just gets along, right? In this kind of utopian crap. But rather what solidarity means is that you have, in my view at least, you have this commitment to hear each other out, right, and share a space, right, with a recognition that you're kind of invested in moving in kind of one direction and you need each other, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that idea of intersectionality, where we all do come from different places and different perspectives, but we share more in common than we have different.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something, I spent long years, especially like in high school and college in particular, in political activism and, you know, in the punk rock community, right? And yeah, exactly. And so much of it was defined, right, as kind of we are, you know, we're like political punks as opposed to goths and opposed to like, you know, this group and that group.
Oh, music is terrible. For young people, you parse each other apart into like little sections where it's kind of like, oh, well, I don't like that band, so, you know, that means you're this, and it's so dumb.
Yeah, it really is. And like, you know, I remember like the struggles of like, you know, I loved Dead Kennedys, I loved Crass, and I loved Bauhaus, and I loved Duran Duran, for Christ's sake, right? It's true, right? Yeah. And so I remember, the, you know, negotiating these lines of kind of like, okay, what do I disclose to this different group and so others? And,
yeah,
you know, it's only been since really thinking about, you know, for myself at least, when I really started doing serious union work, to really say, you know what, if we're in this, you know, we're in this space together trying to move forward and trying to recognize that together we have power, we have collaborative power, then it's not about like, I'm right, you're wrong, right? Or trying to find out what is the most, you know, I don't know, pure space or pure articulation of something. It's having to kind of do that messy work, right? Of kind of getting your hands dirty, so to speak, of actually working with real everyday people.
Well, and recognizing your biases and being able, like, I remember one time we were in a graduate class and we were in a discussion about a piece of poetry or something. And this person started talking about, you know, like they went home to like a town in coal country in upstate Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Which gets a little spicy sometimes if you're like a liberal thinker, quote unquote. And they were commenting on the t-shirts the people were wearing, like the bands, like, oh, you know, yeah, it was Metallica, it was this, that, and the other thing. And I was looking at this person and they had a band t-shirt on. And I was like, well, you're both wearing band t-shirts. Like, so there's an inherent classism though, along with that right. distinction in clothing of all things. And yeah. So, you know, you're wearing a different band t-shirt. It doesn't matter. You both like music, like whatever, like you can both dance. You both enjoy music for the same reasons. So you like one over the other. So what? Like, it doesn't make one better than the other.
Yeah. And what would a conversation look like about, hey, we both love music and different music. What do you like about this as opposed to what I like about this? And by the way, you know what, if you like this and I like this and there's nobody in this area that is promoting local bands, why don't we get together about something and think about how we actually make this happen, right?
Right.
I mean,
for diversity of experiences and reaching the most people and bringing the most people together.
Exactly. And then it's actually like laying out this choice. We could go off into our little camps, right, and say about why I'm better than you are and nobody has any live music around, or we could think about how to create stuff, right, in this kind of like DIY community spirit. So
exactly.
Yeah, cool. And that's a shout out to all the folks from Poser from back in Syracuse days, right? Punks of Syracuse United for Resistance, who actually,
awesome.
Did exactly that, right? Started putting on shows, right? Decided, just sick of complaining about stuff, and started getting people together for these big meetings and asking questions about how we do stuff. So I think you're right. I mean, community is a great place to begin. Cool. So that gives you a little kind of a background. And now I'm reluctantly turning to the farm bill here, folks. reluctantly, because here's the hard thing for me, Colleen, about, you know, looking at the farm bill and looking at some of the policy issues that we've got slated to talk about over the course of this podcast, is that we're in this context where, you know, it's like, everything sucks, right?
Yeah.
I mean, everything coming down seems to suck and things. And what I'm hoping, kind of looking at something, what's happening with the farm bill right now, or what's happening in some of policies or politics and stuff, the idea here is not simply to talk about how everything sucks, right? But look, kind of one, in my mind at least, kind of inform and then set this out as like, okay, here's something that now we need to think about how we kind of come at this. What do we do about this stuff and how does this impact us?
Well, and the farm bill is so unwieldy it covers so many different things, and we don't talk about it at all. I can't remember the last time it was in a major news network discussion, like talking about what exactly is included in it. But it does. It affects everything, and it's tied into our international trade laws, and it's tied into large multinational corporations, and it's supposed to be a vehicle to assist farmers. But the definitions and the classifications within it have become so narrow and specialized that small farmers are getting they're not getting anything. They're not getting any help. And more of what is allotted to them from a previous bill is now being shifted over to multinationals and factory farming. And it affects everything. That affects your daily, everybody's. Like this bill affects everybody's life, and we never talk about it.
No, I think it was interesting. There was, because there's been this debate going on about the farm bill right now, and there's attempts to kind of, you know, well, let's just step back a little bit. Is one of the things that was interesting, I was listening to a conversation about the farm bill. And again, no, it was not mainstream media. It was on one of the other podcasts I listened to. And they were talking a little about one of the people being interviewed. I wish I could remember who it was, but was saying, so the origins of the farm bill, right? So the bargain that was struck by kind of attaching food stamps to the farm bill was to get buy-in from, say, kind of some more urban areas that would kind of like look and say, well, why does this affect me, right? And to kind of get some buy-in from folks in kind of in poorer regions of the state that maybe not necessarily are farming areas, and to bring them together. And in exchange, the idea was this will actually help local farmers, right? And this will help kind of farmers in the states actually by subsidizing the purchase of their food, right? So I said, man, this is kind of a really interesting way of putting together a piece of legislation, right? And the best intentions of it, you know, you're looking to bridge gaps between communities. And the worst intention of it, we see what's happening now.
Well, and with tying the rural and the urban together like that, the money that's allotted then to the SNAP program goes back within the community because you're supporting small farmers. So you get a positive feedback loop that's going on economically. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't.
Well, and recently, like my understanding too, recently, like they're attempting to shift more of this money over to multinationals now.
Oh, they are completely. It's supporting because there's the three grains that they say are vital to everybody on planet Earth's life: wheat, corn, and what's the other one?
Quinoa, right? Quinoa.
Soy. Quinoa actually is really interesting because it can handle heat and drought, and it would actually be very useful to start farming more of it in more regions, especially now that we're trying to find out what works and what doesn't, rather than depending on like Monsanto to come up with a DNA spliced line of something that also has the Terminator seed in it. So it can't be replanted. You can't save the seeds and stuff. Anyway, quinoa is interesting. Oh, also because it has all of that, that negative social aspect around it, because it's like, oh, well, we're eating all of this country's quinoa, blah, 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 blah. When in reality, the conversation should be, why aren't we growing this here? Not so instead of, you know, taking it from a country of origin where the people who are farming it aren't actually getting the largest cut of the profits from it, just say, well, why don't we change over our growing systems? And then you get the large farming corporations that are like, well, that would cost too much money because we would have to change this, that, and the other thing, blah, 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 blah. So instead they just pour it into the same old crops with, genetically modified seeds so that they can handle more pesticide. So you can put more pesticide on the ground. So that doesn't work anyway because the bugs are smarter than we are.
Yeah, and they will always be smarter than we are when it comes to, like, adapting.
Right. And they reproduce a lot faster. So when you're looking at a single, you're looking at generations and generations and generations over like 10 years of insects that are evolving constantly. And we're like, oh, yeah, no, this is totally cool. We know what we're doing. You know.
Yeah, no, totally. I was thinking about this morning. My son came home yesterday because, you know, it's the end of the school year, and they had their final research project for the year was on insects. Right. And he chose the milkweed bug.
Right? Yeah.
They actually had a had them hatch in their classroom, and they kind of were studying the milkweed bug and this kind of, which is really cool. And you know, it talks about the reproductive cycle, the milkweed bug, and like a couple days or something like this, right? Or a couple weeks maybe, and how many eggs are laid and things like that. I said, oh yeah, the bugs will win ultimately.
Oh yeah. Cockroaches will run the planet.
Exactly.
Yeah, and freaking morning glories. Oh my God, don't ever plant morning glories. No one ever plant morning glories. Just don't ever plant morning glories.
I'm glad you just said that, because, you know, I've been thinking about, I have this is totally tangent. By the way, tangents are a feature of this show. And if you don't like tangents, then, you know, I don't know what to tell you, because this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, just hang on for the ride. It's
just
fine.
Like, yeah, exactly. Grab onto something, grab a beer, grab something to drink, you know, have, you know, and just relax, sit outside as you're listening, right? Let your mind go, right?
But, yep.
You know, last year, I just as an experiment, there's a, I bought this, it's not exactly a trellis, but it's, you know, it's this thing that you stick in the ground and stuff grows on, right? Whatever it is. And it's about 6 feet tall. And I just wanted to kind of play around with hops, right? And I knew that hops were, you know, this thing was not going to support like full hops vines, right? I just wanted to kind of see what it was, to start a process. What's that?
Just to see what would happen. See if your land was good. See if this.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. And it completely flopped, right? 100% flopped.
What happened?
They just didn't grow. I don't know. I don't know. I put it like I dug up the soil and kind of put in the kind of soil they're supposed to grow in and stuff. But, you know, I ordered it from this like kind of organic company that kind of grows hops for distribution and whatever. And they came packaged nice. And I don't know what happened. I'm sure I did something wrong, and I just don't know. But one of them finally grew, but it wasn't until like it didn't start growing until August, and I had planted it like in the spring. Uh-huh. So by the time it got like, you know, whatever, the waist high, it was our winter was coming. So it wasn't going anywhere. But anyways, nothing's come up at all this year for it. So I'm just gonna dig those up, and I'm gonna store them for a little bit, at least the three ones that didn't do anything, and see what I can do. And I'm just gonna plant something else on that, some kind of viney thing. And I was like, well, maybe I'll look up a vine or something. So, but I will tick it off. No morning glories.
Yeah, no morning glories. You'll be trying to get rid of them. They take over everything. And I would not be surprised if they somehow create an enzyme or something in the soil that reduces the growth of other things, because I have to get them early or else they'll just like wreck everything. And then they eat everything. In August, there's just like morning glories everywhere.
Right,
Right. They're terrible. They're terrible. They're really pretty, but they're terrible. But and it's weird that you weren't able to grow hops. We had a friend of ours gave us one, I think it was a male, and we grew it just to see what would happen. Cause that's pretty much my garden. It's just an experiment every year. Mm-hmm. And that thing went fucking nuts.
Really?
It was, oh God. And they grow everywhere really fast. And a friend of mine wants to grow hops too, but she has an idea to actually get used telephone poles.
Yes.
So that they have that much space to grow up. Cause they are insane.
Yeah. That's, I mean, so, it really, I mean, I know if you want to grow them, you really, what's that?
You call the company and ask them like, if you should try maybe a different variety of hops or something.
I have it. I'm going to will this summer. And I'm just going to say, hey, this is kind of what happened. And just kind of like, what would you suggest about it?
Or anybody listening to this show, please leave a response.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And if like, and especially if you're a PA grower, right. And you have hops locally, and you know, let me know. I mean, I would love, and we could, you know, we'll talk about it. If you kind of send us some stuff or you kind of send us like some information, I'll be happy to buy it from you. I'm not asking for free stuff here. But you know, that'd be awesome. And we could have it as a little ongoing experiment throughout the summer.
Yeah. And what county are you in? Cause that'll give them a more specific.
I'm in Bucks County. Yep. Upper Bucks. So kind of like, I'm in Perkasie. So it's kind of like considered Upper Bucks, I guess. So, but no, cool. And I think it's good. I actually originally contacted there's a brewery in upstate New York that is kind of like literally like a bike ride away from the house I grew up in. Wasn't there when I was young, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, depends how you cut that. But it's called Woodland. I guess it's just brewery now, but it was originally Hop Farm and Brewery. and their original plan was to grow their own hops and things like this. But they've had when I talked to them, they actually had to kind of shelve the whole hop farm part a little bit because their brewery took off so fast. So they had the idea of this is going to be the growth. So, but I originally contacted them and say, hey, blah blah blah, and they're like, actually, we're not doing that right now. We're doing a little bit more slower process, so we're not ready to send them out. So, oh, okay, but. Yeah, so that's that. You know, that's the backyard. That's the garden. And as you see, how quickly we got from the farm bill to.
Nobody wants to talk about the farm bill. It's just a pain in the neck.
Yeah,
but we have to talk about it. We have to, because it does also. Well, and I think for this program, especially talking about not just the fact that SNAP is receives a hefty chunk of it, but that there have been, there's been funding in there for farmers markets and local food promotion programs. And they also offer value added grants. What else is it? The Rural Energy for America program. And there's more that specifically work to support small scale local agriculture and communities. And one of the reasons that I find this fascinating is because, all right, let's take France because I love France because it's beautiful and the food is so goddamn good. But what you see with that country is national subsidies for their bread. So, and bread over there is not just like, it's not wheat. It's not like in our country where we think of like, well, our wheat production is subsidized. So that's subsidizing our bread production. Each bakery has their own combination of flours. So they're not, it's not just like one kind of wheat they have spent in some cases generations working out the specifics of these ratios and the water that they use and all this kind of stuff. And they have very specific methods and the ovens mean something to them. So you can get a baguette for, I think the American equivalent is around 90 cents. It's supported by, because the nation doesn't want to see people starve. So it subsidizes generously local agriculture production. So, you know, you go over there and you've got vineyards and you've got olive orchards and you've got chestnut orchards and you've got all these things, and you'll see people come together during harvest time and help with the harvest and stuff like that. And they have this ancient tradition of doing that within their communities. And the reason that for me, I see small scale farming as a method of resistance is because we then take control of our local communities, but with our farming communities and with the support of them, we're taking more control of our food supply chain. And we're bringing money back into our communities, and all of that helps strengthen a community. Because there's this one cookbook I was reading for research. I think it's Patricia Wells' book, but I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure right now. But she has little vignettes of the communities where she finds these recipes and stuff like that. And she pulls this one recipe out of this really rural community that when World War II was happening, they weren't really that affected. Because their community was so isolated, but also so self-sufficient that, you know, and they weren't in the line of fire. Like France, the Marseille has been rebuilt pretty much 90% from, it was destroyed during World War II. Right. And you, like flying over, you can see, I wasn't sure what I was looking at the first time I saw it, but you would see forests, but all the trees would be in a straight line. And I realized that was from replanting. That all that forest had been completely demolished. Wow. And annihilated, and they went back and replanted, and you know, they planted them in straight lines.
Yeah, we're doing it in Paris. The figure might as well do it out here too as well.
Right. All roads lead to Paris. And it's true. But yeah, I think that value that they place as a national culture, like as a nation state culture, I think is something that we need to start developing and growing ourselves. We have to have more of appreciation for that. And I think we had it at one point, you know, like with the Victory Gardens and stuff. Right. Like that, there was an understanding and people would, you know, donate, what was it, their aluminum pots and stuff like that. And there were calls for all these different kinds of materials, and people would actually do it. And we've completely and utterly, we're a total 180. From that point in time.
Well, you know, imagine you just think about those different ethics, right? A sense of nation grounded in food versus a sense of nation grounded in war, right?
Right. Food and community. They go hand in hand. And yeah, punitive. That's what I keep thinking that our nation has become, is that we're a punitive country now. And I don't understand that at all.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. Well, first, let me say, go back to the baguette thing, just as a side comment, is that, you know, I bet you there's enough people, you know, I mean, France is known for its intellectual culture, too, as well, and its historical culture. So I'm sure that there's policymakers that still remember that the storming of the Bastille was rooted in bread, right? So,
oh, my God. Right? Seriously, one of the craziest things, walking the streets of Paris, one of the craziest, it gives me the chills just thinking about it, is walking down an avenue and realizing that the cobblestones you're walking on literally ran with blood.
Yep.
It's not a, you know.
Metaphor.
Or hyperbole. Like it's not an exaggeration of any way, shape, or form. You're not gilding it in anything. but the streets literally ran with blood, and it was bread.
Yep, exactly. Right. And it's interesting that just kind of this echo, right? I could imagine, like, you know, anyone gets a little out of line, like, remember the Bastille.
Oh, hell yeah, right? Those guys seriously right. know how to protest. Holy moly. Well,
and I was thinking about, you know, the example that you gave of, the rural community in France. That was Marseille? That was you said? No. What?
Well, Marseille is not rural.
I don't know anything about France, so.
No, Marseille is a beautiful cosmopolitan port town.
Okay.
That's kind of edgy, that has great music, and oh my God, just some of the most beautiful boats you'll ever see. Anyway, the rural community, the place that recipe came from, I think it was up in the north.
Okay.
But I can't remember, and I don't remember which book it's
put out. Yeah, but here's what I was thinking. Like, this just reminded me of this. Yesterday, I had to go kind of up in outside of Ricketts Glen area, right? So I was up in the mountains yesterday. My in-laws, they have my mother-in-law, so they have, you know, they saved their whole life and they bought this land. My father-in-law who passed a couple years ago, but when he and his brother were growing up, they grew up in Philadelphia and they went up north to go hunting, right? And there's this particular area on land that they always used to go on. And they got lucky once that somebody was selling about 60 acres of land dirt cheap. Right? Yeah. So they went to all their friends and family to borrow whatever they could scrape together, right? Because they were not, like, they did not have money. Scraped together to buy this land because it was such a deal. And they bought it. So each of them, the brothers, split it, 30 acres and 30 acres, right? On the opposite sides of this one road.
Oh, wow.
So, cool. Yeah. So, you know, we spent time up there, bring our kids up there and stuff. And it's a cool area. But I was just up there yesterday. We had to, like, mow the lawn, like, literally 2 hours, 2.5 hours up, mow the freaking lawn, deal with some water issues, and then drive back. Right. Whatever. But
yeah.
The next door neighbor of my wife's aunt, who's, you know, she's at home now. Her husband passed away last year. But their neighbor was this woman who, I won't get into the whole backstory, but she just basically died from a heroin overdose on Thursday, this past Thursday. Right. And she had like a junior, her daughter or her adopted daughter lived in the house too as well. And she was like probably 16 or 17 years old or something like this. It was just devastating. Right. And, you know, there's all the stuff that goes around with it. But the reason why I bring this up is that you have that is one picture of what's happening in this rural community, right, in Pennsylvania. This is also happening in an area that is being fracked like you wouldn't believe. And about 2 miles down the road from where we stay is where I think it's the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline is going through. So they just caught this huge swath, like, through the forest, right, and through this land that goes across wetlands, that follows the path of streams, right? And basically locals up there are, like, they're not going to be critical for the most part of what's going on because they have no work. And the opioid crisis has taken over. Industry is gone. right? And I'm thinking about that as the contrast to what you, the example that you just gave.
Yeah.
Right? Imagine if our investments were different, where you didn't have a desperation class of people that were forced to hope for a pipeline, as opposed to food that would give sustenance, right?
Yep.
That would give, and not just sustenance, but nurturance and community and care, as opposed to devastation and loss. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. Exactly. Like, and there's so, there have been, yeah, because your budget reflects your priorities and your values.
Right.
And that's just a fact. It's not, they can be filled with idealism and you can be thinking that your people are worth the best. And I think back to FDR with his arts programs and with the forestry programs and, you know, putting people to work and giving people jobs and also beautifying our country and building communities while they were doing it. Or you can spend, you know, you can have a military budget.
Right.
And then you can use 50% of your discretionary spending to go to the military. So what that lists your priorities, and we don't, our federal government does not reflect any kind of human values. We don't value education. We don't value healthcare. We don't value food, but we do value, you know, subsidizing multinational corporations that end up paying no taxes and then who get refunds from our tax money.
Yep.
That's where we are today. That's fucked up.
Yep. It's like they value those things only insofar as they can be turned into mass commodities, right, and reproduced. So if it's the privatization of education, if it's the, you know, kind of internationalization of mass food production, right, the factory farming model of food production, you know, if it's healthcare that can be kind of traded on, like, I don't know, a commodities exchange program as opposed to about principles of care, right? I've been thinking a lot about that lately just because, you know, and part of it has to do, it's not like this has ever been far removed from any conversation I've ever had with anybody, but I think that, you know, this, you know, organization that is now in power, right? The Trump organization and the whole guilt, I think brings that into kind of more relief and kind of saying, look, how far have we got away from our values, with a full recognition that, you know, this is not something that was just brought to us by, you know, Trump. Right. This has been a long time move. And so the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, they have all been part of this dynamic that has, you know, moved us slowly, I think slowly away from a kind of a principles of care. And I'm careful about that, too, as well, because I don't want to suggest there's some sort of golden age. Right. Because, like, you know,
yeah.
But it's like, at least it seemed to me that those values were more active on a national kind of discussion level than they are now. With everything seems to be today is about, you know, what can we trade and how do we trade it away and at what price can we get for it?
Which is all subjective anyway, because then you look, I think of, is it Ida, oh my God, I can't remember her name, Turnbull?
Turnbull, yeah.
With her expose on the Pennsylvania oil production.
Exactly.
Because of her family and stuff like that. And you see, like, through her writing, you see these different relationships that affect the rest of the nation and just from this small area, which is another reason that I think the stuff with fracking in Pennsylvania is so fucked up, because we've been through this before. You know, like, we've been here. We were the first state where oil became a moneymaker. And here we are again working with another kind of fossil fuel kind of an extraction process that's worse than it ever was.
Exactly.
And we already have. And then with the coal, I mean, we've already got a town. Satroni is still on fucking fire. And how many decades has it been? You know, like, how many times do you have to do the same thing before you learn from your mistakes?
Yeah, I think, yes, I echo that 100%. And it blows my mind. It's like, this is, you know, you talk to people, this is something I just don't understand, right? And this is, I don't know, I'll never quite get my head around that, is that, you know, we've learned this now through the oil industry, through the coal industry. And here we are again with the natural gas industry. And then suddenly it's like everyone, the boosters are all in, everyone's kind of going up, yeah. We're all going to get behind. It's like this, it's almost the identical language, yeah. And promises that we saw any other kind of extractive industry here. And meanwhile, you know, and this is happening in my mind. It's worse now, precisely because that the impacts of going whole hog on this are talking about devastation, not just locally, but the planet.
Yeah. Right?
And especially when you're talking about what happens when you're actually polluting millions of gallons of water per year. Right.
Not only pulling them out of the aquifers, but then polluting them to the point that they will never be usable again.
Exactly. Like never. Like not just usable for the next 10 years, but ever.
Never. Because of the radioactive components, materials that are in there, the salinity, like all of it. And then the stuff that doesn't have to be disclosed because of intellectual property rights. Like how? I mean, and I can't even ask the question, how did we get here? Because you can map how we got here.
Right.
And people have mapped how we got here. But still the question becomes, how the fuck did we get here? How did this, you know, and you can say it was low voting numbers, it was, you know, disenfranchisement, you could say it's all these things, but still, like, Jesus, how were there no adults in the room at some point in time that would be like, hey, like, maybe this really isn't a good idea.
Well, you know, this is what I think, I look at it like this, right? And this is one thing that's like frustrated the hell out of me about with the Trump administration, when we talk about this kind of like adults in the room thing, right? And I think that's actually part of the problem. Is the problem that we've thought that the adults, there's going to be adults in a room someplace else, right? That are going to do these things. And really what, you know, again, this brings us right back to kind of where we started. It's about, we've said, we've allowed to say that, you know, the locus of power is someplace else in some experts or something like this, as opposed to with us. Right.
Well, and I think it comes down to trust too. And this is something that I think can help explain where we are, is that people are, and I fully and absolutely believe this, especially because of where we are now, people are genuinely, like, within, the majority of people are good and they trust other people. So we trust that these people that we're electing, even if it's not as many as, like, even if the percentage points are as high as they should be for a fully democratic election, even if we're electing these people, we trust that they are going to not harm us. And that's not the case.
No.
And I think, and we saw that with the Republican Congress all through the Obama administration, is that those people that we pay their health insurance, we pay their security, we pay their office, we pay all this stuff for them. They are out to intentionally harm us.
Yes.
And I like wrapping your head around that, I think is maybe something that we really have to do.
You think?
they have no, and it's the same thing with people that support like large corporations, the interests of large corporations. It's like, they don't care about you. They don't have your best interest in heart. They don't, if you die, they don't care. You are fully expendable. You are collateral damage. Like, that's it. Like, just believe that.
No. And I think that's one thing that, you know, throughout American history, like periodically, every once in a while, people seem to get that, right?
Yeah.
And then that's, but it's only at the time of the heights of political organizing, when we get past that sense and say, start to turn towards each other and say that it's this, look, is this what we want? Forget what those people are saying. Is this what we want? Right? They're offering us a choice between Colgate and Crest, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we should turn to each other and ask, like, well, what is, like, okay, that's their choices that they're offering us. What choices do we want on the table? What kind of life do we want? You know, and I think, you know, this is why this stuff that, you know, with the farm bill, when you're talking about, you know, pulling money away, it's like at the base level of subsistence, pulling money away from people who are like just trying to get like food on the table for their kids. Right. And saying, and somehow saying, no, those people don't deserve it. Who deserves it is Monsanto. Who deserves it are these kind of like multinational corporations, who are the very people that will contribute to a process of ripping the food out of those mouths too, as well. So it's a double whammy.
Yeah, but they know better because they're experts.
Yep, they're experts. And you know what? If and I'll pull in a sound clip from our other podcast, because Michelle, I'm forgetting her name right now. Oh my God, it's driving me crazy. I don't know if Michelle Wolf, right?
Uh-huh.
And Michelle Wolf always says, like, you know, oh, you're going to do this because he's a doctor, right? He's a doctor. Oh, everything's going to be okay, right? The Democrats, oh, it's okay. They're going to get behind this other guy over here, even though they're kind of pro-corporate and all this stuff. Why? Because, oh, he's a doctor, right?
Exactly.
It's the same, you know, the idea that we're willing to hand over our lives with people that are experts, people who have, like, letters after their name and all this kind of stuff. And just on that grounds alone, and say, well, they must know what they're doing, and they do know what they're doing, but it's not in our interest.
Right. It's not, and they're not honest. They're right. It's like, you look at our current president, who is, you know, legally and officially, he is supposed to be our negotiator. Like he's treaties and international relations. That's supposed to be his office, and he can't be trusted.
Right.
He says he lies. I mean, how do you even, the fuck, how is that even? And I mean honestly, I'm just glad that, like, you know, because when he was first elected, and the one diplomat, I can't remember which country because everyone's freaking out, but the one diplomat was like, you know, we just thought this was a blip in American, you know, politics and stuff, and now they're just like, wait, we're not sure about this anymore. And they, yeah, he's completely insane. And he's an idiot, and he lies, and he knows about it. And I don't, the fuck.
Well, no. The big question I have, Colleen, is: do you have an opinion about this, or?
Let me tell you.
Oh my God, it's crazy.
It's so many hate hits.
Oh, good. Bring them on, folks. We're going to learn from the right on this one. Like, come on. We'll do that. Hey, any attention is good attention, right?
No. Right. No, and especially with me as a woman, this is going to be like, make Gamergate look like nothing.
There you go. Oh, my God. Well, let's, before we go to a break, I want to say, you know, one of the things that we were talking about a little bit before the show today, you had some, you know, you came across this website called Civil Eats that was just, I mean, I've never heard of it before, and you kind of like, or I guess, you know, reading a bunch of this stuff and going to the background and stuff, but what they're doing is fantastic, right? I mean, I just want to kind of like drive as much traffic to their website as possible, right? I mean, it's got like civileats.com, but yeah, amazing place.
It is, and I got, I found so much shit when I was in my MPA program but I think this is one of them. But yeah, they're good. There's one thing that you will find in agriculture is that everybody, well, not except, all right, that's not true. A lot of people are very, a lot of what they're doing is pushing forward with optimism because they don't have an option. Farmers have to be optimistic because there are so many variables that are completely out of their control,
right,
that everything they do is in good faith. Like, they plant hoping that the plants will make it, there won't be a hailstorm, that the water will be good, that they won't get a drought. Like, and so you will see a lot of community building and positive narratives within the farming community. I'm trying to see if I can find their mission statement.
Let me see.
Yeah, I mean, just food and policy. When you go to their website, it's business, faces and visions, the farm bill, food and farm labor, food justice, food policy, good food vanguard. Like, they're freaking awesome.
Pretty awesome. Yeah, so check those folks out because they have, just poking through their website, and this is something that I hope we can do too as well on Free Range, is kind of direct people to a bunch of resources and things that where people are having these conversations. Is one of the things that when you start having conversations like this and you start looking beyond, like, kind of like thoughts in your head, so to speak, and say, hey, who else is doing this stuff out there, is what you find out, there's actually really interesting stuff going on.
And a lot of people are actively working on this stuff, but you don't ever hear about it because, right. You know, we don't have local press. We don't have local television. You know, our local TV stations don't get to promote local causes. They get, you know, a theme dictated down them from their mother station or father station. Because
corporate overlords.
Yeah. Corporate overlords. And I think that I want to do the same thing. Like every week, introduce a new resource and a new farmer to people so that they can start thinking about, you know, what do they see that's like that in their community?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that Colleen and I have talked about is, you know, like I belong to a local CSA, Bloomy Glen Farms over here. We've got, I didn't even know it was a thing, but apparently it is, but a CSB right here, a community supported bakery. Right. My friend Ryman.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's and they have shares. They're selling shares just like this. It's an absolutely amazing place. It's the Bread Box and Bakery in Perkasie, Pennsylvania. Really amazing stuff. And, you know, Ryman and I, who owns that, he also owns Down to Earth Cafe here in Perkasie. He's thought a lot. And people that are doing this work have thought a lot about community and building connections and kind of what they're doing as important. Not just as a business model, right, but as a way of actually remaking our communities. And so one of the things that Colleen and I have talked about is, like, you know, as we get, you know, the gears oiled on this little kind of organic bio machine, if you will, that is this podcast, you know, to maybe kind of get on location in some places and kind of interview some of these folks and to bring those again to this space as a way of, you know, bringing our experiences and the kind of networks and the connections that we have to as well back into this space too as well to help facilitate and kind of direct those questions too. So,
yeah. And I think it's interesting that we come at the same kind of community development and community support kind of project from very different spaces, like, but that parallel one another so much, because your background in labor and activism and all that kind of stuff completely parallels the work that I've done in community development and, you know, supporting arts and developing food networks and stuff. It's a very holistic kind of approach to the idea of community development and building community.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we talked about when we were first trying to wrap our heads around, you know, how we come at these things from different spaces and things was, you know, it just occurred to me is that, you know, cause for me, and I think, I don't know, you tell me, but for me, it's like, you know, labor organizing and union movements and things like that. It's not just about like the union for the sake of the union, right? And not that space just for the sake of that space, as that is just the capital G good. It's a way of getting to a different way of thinking about the future, right? I mean, for me, it's been about why would we kind of like refuse to have a king yet accept a dictator at our workspace, right? And so if we have a dictator at our workspace that is codified in law and policy and all this other stuff, how do we change that, right, to bring about the kind of democratic revolution in our everyday spaces that we kind of accept as part of our, you know, school age stories about American history. Well, the labor movement is the one who's been at the forefront of that.
And it's also rooted in the farm labor movement. Dolores Huertas, was that her name?
Huertas, yep.
Yeah. Everything that she did. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, one of my first.
I just got really excited.
That's how you know. That's Colleen's tell when she goes, yep.
And then I start giggling like.
That's awesome. Well, you know, I remember like when I was in college, one of the first movements, social movements that really just kind of I just went dove into was the whole populist movement. Right. When they looked at what was happening in like Wisconsin, I guess. Right. Wisconsin with the. Or was it Minnesota? Wisconsin, I think, with the banks basically like robbing farmers, right? And the farmers, they say, well, let's screw them. Why don't we just do this for ourselves, right? And again, it was a complicated history and all that other kind of stuff. But it was that same kind of question, right? The question of like, wait a minute, instead of like choosing among bad choices that are out there, what would it look like if we turned towards each other?
Exactly.
And say what we could do. Cool. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, folks. And when we come back after this, we're going to talk about
Going to drink a beer.
Yeah, we're actually going to drink a beer. That's a rule for this podcast, by the way. Right. So if that offends you in any way, it was nice to know you. And we'll talk to you soon.
If that offends you. Oh, my God.
Exactly. If that offends you, you're definitely in the wrong spot.
That was way too easy. Bye.
Exactly. We'll come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about small scale farming, so regenerative agriculture and so on. And again, as usual, see where the conversation takes us. So
we'll at least start with those topics.
Yeah, well, who the hell knows, right? Well, this is Kevin Mahoney.
And Colleen Fitzgerald.
And this is Free Range Podcast. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Free Range Podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney.
And this is Colleen Fitzgerald.
And we're back. Yes, we made it through the break. Can you believe it? And we have officially popped open the beer for this section. Yeah, truth be told, we had popped it open earlier because I think we got so frustrated with some of the sound issues but for officially, we just popped open the beer. So what are you drinking, Colleen?
A Hefeweizen. That German one.
That German one?
Which one is it? I'm never going to get this right. Weihenstephaner.
We'll go with that.
Actually, I think it's from Freising, Germany.
There you go. Well, I'm drinking something decidedly more local, which is like literally walking distance from my house from Free Will Brewing. And if you've listened to Out to Coop podcast from Raging Chicken Press, you know we do a segment called Last Call where it's beer and space news. So because we can. Right? And so I'm drinking the Kregel IPA. And for those of you who've watched the Lego movie, you know the reference. Colleen has not watched the Lego movie, and I have not. I've purposely not told her anything about the movie because I just want her to, you know, watch it and so see why it's relevant to this podcast. So
I'm kind of excited now. I'm intrigued.
Yes, exactly. So anybody is there's actually, you know, I have to say at Free Will they have the Kregel, and they have, and I did tell her about this one part. They have another beer called Lord Business. So. So there's some Lego fans going on over there. All right. So in kind of our segment, we'll kind of come back after the break. We'll do a whole bunch of different stuff throughout the podcast. One of the things we'll do today, we're going to kind of bring it in, folks, talk a little bit more about, you know, the kind of stuff about getting your hands dirty stuff, you know, kind of some of the movements that are happening in food and in agriculture, or it's cool stuff that we think to talk about. And then each podcast, we'll have Colleen's also going to preview some of the farms that she's working with, some of the people behind those farms. So we've got kind of small scale farming is kind of and we've already talked a little bit about that a little bit. But what are you thinking about?
So I think maybe it would be, I don't know. I think maybe it would be beneficial to define regenerative agriculture.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if, how familiar people are with the term at all. And so it's, the actual definition is that it's an approach to food and farming systems that rejects pesticides, artificial fertilizers, and claims to regenerate topsoil. It doesn't claim to. It does. It actually regenerates topsoil. It increases biodiversity, water cycles. It enhances ecosystems. And it does this by looking at all of the different components of a farm. I'm doing a really bad job describing. So it's a holistic look at farming. So it's not looking at, you know, a single crop that you're going to be producing on a large scale, but it's looking at, the idea that you have chickens that can, whose waste you can age and then use as a fertilizer. It's looking at all at, if you have, cows on the land or pigs, the way that their hooves can turn the soil. It's looking at a farm as an ecosystem, not just as this thing, not as an industrial site for production, but that it is an organic and holistic community, and that the different components of it not just nurture, but they help create a better life for all the different elements of the farm.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the, you know, I don't know what you think of that movie, Food Inc. You know that, have you seen that movie, Food Inc.?
I did a long time ago.
Well,
yeah.
It reminds me of the farmer, I'm just spacing his name at this point, they preview towards the latter half of the movie where he basically has a system where the cows are. What's that?
The guy with the hat?
Yeah. Yeah. Like he the cows graze on a particular pasture until until you know the grass is down and they move on to the next one, and now the cows have kind of like pooped all over the place, right? In that pasture, then they let in the chickens because in all that poop are bugs and worms and all this other kind of stuff. So the chickens go and they peck at all that stuff and kind of work some of that the manure into the soil. Right. And then there's something else. There's another part of it, too, as well. And they lay it fallow or something like that, which kind of regenerates part of the soil. That's kind of what was going through my mind as you were talking about that.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Food Inc.'s a great movie. And I was trying to bring up this article. I think I found his name. Modern Farmer is the magazine is also a great resource. They have a lot of really good articles on small farmers and practices that they're developing and improving on. Yeah, that's a great resource.
Modern Farmer. So anybody out there listening for Modern Farmer, we'd happily take on your sponsorship. Thank you very much. As long as it gets the Colleen
subscription, that's cool.
As long as Colleen gets the seal of approval on it, then I'm willing to go with it.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. So that's regenerative agriculture. Its name is what it is. It's looking at things in a different from a different perspective. And again, like, I mean, we've talked about this for the industrial mindset that Americans have grown up in being so, invasive is the only word I can think of, but being so invasive in our everyday lives that we don't even realize that our systems are set up as much as they are from the industrial perspective, where you're looking at what they consider to be, decisions for economy. Mm-hmm. So economy of motion, of all of it, like where you just have one person doing one thing because then they don't have to go do this, that, and the other thing, and not looking at but not looking at things in a holistic way, that we aren't machines. Yeah. and that farming isn't an industry. It's something, it's so much more than that. And yeah, that's it.
Well, that's it. Well, no, but it reminds me of, you know, the first time I ever started when I learned about this is actually back when I was doing some organizing work with the global justice movement in D.C. Right. So I was working as an adjunct at George Washington University. And it was right after the, the WTO protest in Seattle, the battle in Seattle. And then it came to the IMF and World Bank protest in D.C. And it was in that process that. Is really, I would have to say, is the first time that I really was not forced is the wrong word, but it was brought into my attention about how important what was happening in questions of food policy and water policy and so on. And it was also the first time that I learned about like slow food movement. Right.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, hearing about some of the origins and reading some of the books. And again, I'm going to forget the guy's name. You probably know who I'm talking about. But the guy who one of the I don't know, godfathers, right, of the slow food movement in Italy, one of the decisions that they made was, okay, all businesses have to close down for like, I don't know, it was 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day, right? Because if you were going to support local agriculture, right, and have a sustainable model of how we deal with food and culture, then people were going to be able to spend the time to have a lunch at these local like establishment that were using local ingredients. And I was like, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, but we're set to an industrial clock that's like 9 to 5 and that has been increasingly turned to like 7 to 5. So we don't. Yeah. There's no time for anything. And I think that's one of the frustrations that concerns me most when we talk about community building is that people don't have time.
Right.
Period. And at this point, I'm pretty sure 50% of the people I know are working 2 jobs.
Yep.
And I don't think that's an exaggeration for one reason or another. And for some of them, it's to cover healthcare costs of a partner, you know, and there's no time. And I think that I gotta stop saying that. are because it's obvious that I think that I'm saying it.
We're going meta here, folks. We're going meta.
Oh, shit. That's only the second year. But we have to talk about that, too, because people feel bad because they can't engage in community development or community growth things. And especially from someone, from me, who has worked so many years in the service industry while doing other things. If you're a bartender or a server, you work on the weekends. Mm-hmm. So when do opportunities for building community happen? On the weekends. So you've got this whole group of people that are either killing themselves to be a part of these things and losing sleep, losing, you know, their house is a mess. They can't even get their laundry done, like these kinds of things, because they're making a choice to actively do this. Or you have people that are so overwhelmed that they just can't make the time. And that, more than anything, is we need to talk more about. Because you know, and I remember this one politician during a primary turning to a woman who was protesting an event. And the person said to her, you know, you should run for office. Well, do you have the ability to run for office? Like, if you want to make a change, you need to run for office. Well, do you really? Like, the hurdles to get there, the disposable income, the disposable time, the human infrastructure that you need to have behind you to run for office is so overwhelming that just to flippantly tell someone that, well, you want to make a difference, run for office, it denies all of that, the reality of all of that.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. We just saw these recent electoral victories out in Pittsburgh, right? Sarah Inamorato, right? Summer Lee, right? And then Elizabeth Fiedler down in Philadelphia. And one of the things that was so interesting about their victories, right, was, you know, one, they're DSA-sponsored folks, like Democratic Socialists of America, right? They're connected to that. But they were connected with communities of resistance, right, in those areas. And one of the things that you saw in some of the national coverage of their races came in, that the three of those women, right, were in constant contact with each other. Right. And Sarah Inamorato. Yeah, it's amazing. Sarah Inamorato. One of the things that she did before she ran for office was she had worked with nonprofit organizations, and she founded one that was about training women about how to get more involved in politics. So, and one of the things, a lot of these national stories or a lot of the, you know, when you look at the surprise victories, what they miss out is the fact that they were connected to these communities, that the only way that that was possible is that they had, like, in the absence of billions of dollars in money and people shovel them to you, and certainly the Democratic Party is not going to do that, right, if you're running on the left, what is to have alternative sources of power and support and resources. And all of those women had that. So,
yeah.
It's a perfect example of that.
Developing communities.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And there's something you were saying that just kind of completely went out of my head too as well. That's what I have to circle back to it. Oh, I know. This is the thing. And we should talk about this at some point down, like in one of our episodes, is that we touched upon this a little bit when in Out the Coop podcast, when we talk about like universal basic income. And there's some interesting questions around universal basic income. And, you know, I don't want to get into it all, kind of sideline us all over here at this point. But one of the things I just imagine if you had precarity removed from your life, right, about what would be possible. Right. I think about this all the time. If I didn't have, like, if health insurance weren't tied to my job, for example, right, my baseline was not a kind of like, oh, either I'm going to work whatever job I can find, right, or I'm going to starve, right, or I'm going to put my family in jeopardy. Think about what would be possible. Right. And I think about, imagine if I did not have to keep my job as I have it right now, if I could devote so much of my time to Raging Chicken Press, right, knowing that is, you know, it's not going to make hand over fist money, right, but is nonetheless, I believe at least, important in building these kind of communities and networks, right? Imagine that. And again, there's no natural reason for that. That is about a choice.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at the amount of revenue that Wall Street creates on penny stocks, like through penny stocks and through all that bullshit that they do. There is absolutely no reason. And then you have multinational corporations that will say, you know, that will actively sue states and nation states for loss of projected income.
Right.
Like, not even that, to me, that blows my mind. Like, why could I not go to, my loan holder for my student loans and say, well, you know, you owe me this much because I got these degrees, you know, and there was some sort of understanding that there would be a projected income at the end of it, and it didn't work. So give me some money.
Yeah, right. You just violated the contract.
Right. That's what they're doing. And it makes no, there is so much money out there. It's obscene.
No. And I think about this, you know, some of the farmers that you've worked with that, you know, that you've told me about, for example. Right. And I think about, you know, you mentioned like in our last segment, said, you know, you're when you're connected to the land in these ways, right, you're just hoping it's not going to hail and destroy your crop. Right.
Yeah.
You're hoping. And there's real disincentives for doing things like, for example, you know, introducing different kinds of grains, right,
yeah,
into what you're growing on an every, like, yearly
there
because.
There are no incentives. There is right. not, there is not, they, and you're starting to see, sorry to cut you off, but you're starting to see people that are generating, you know, that whole idea and that balance, that economic balance, where if there's not a need for the item, then they're not going to create it. So you're trying to create that need. And I think I want to say it's Wisconsin, where farmers are starting to grow a very specific type of grain. Grain for this. It's a grain. It's definitely a grain
This
brewery that is going to brew their grain from their grains. And so they're creating this, but there is no incentive for them to do it. Like on either side, the cost and the startup costs are so enormous, and the variability in whether or not the grains are actually going to thrive is just so great. But that's what the Farm Bill should be for.
Exactly.
It should be there to provide a buffer so that people can be encouraged to take risks and to learn what works where. Because even this shit that you know, is genetically created in a lab, there's not 100% guarantee that it's going to work. So the money that's spent on that kind of R&D could be put back into human capital and into regenerative practices for the soil that will help make the entire area better.
Yeah, it seems like that's like a no-brainer, right?
Damn it.
I'm just sitting here trying to find this grain that you were talking
grain,
about. I read about this, and I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah.
And what was fascinating about it was exactly that was the kind of intentional move, right? Say, okay, look, we recognize that this grain, in order for it to be produced, is going to be a money loser. So we have to find places for it, right?
Yeah.
And what I found was interesting, I mentioned in my last segment about the Bread Box Bakery, Bread Box and Bakery here in Perkasie, is that they have a bread that they, I don't know if they're still doing on a weekly basis, but they were for a while at least. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't. But they were using spent grain from Free Will, right? Free Will Brewing to bake this bread. And
I've been wondering if that was going to happen.
Yeah. And it's actually, I mean, I've looked at after Ryman told me about this, that they were doing this at the bakery, and I went and got some, and it was fantastic. And it was funny because, you know, this is like the beauty of creativity, which you were talking about before, is one of the things he said is, yeah, we're experimenting with a bunch of different kind of like ratios and all this kind of stuff. So it's going to be different like every week, you know, for a while. I'm like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. So at that time, what's that?
It is awesome. And then they're breaking an established supply chain
exactly,
where you have to get your grains, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You're removing yourself and from this established system. So that is creative dissent right there, which is fucking awesome.
Absolutely. And it's asking that kind of question, right? Saying like, well, what if, hey, there's this other, like there's a brewery in town, right? And there's these farmers that are right down the street. What if we started talking about collaboration stuff, right? What would be possible? And then finding out, oh, look, hey, there's people that make beer bread. Oh, there's a brewery right here. Like, what would it look like if we started talking to them about this stuff? And a way about kind of and reinforcing those networks, right? Reinforcing those networks of power, community, sustainability, and connection. But
yep. Right on, brother.
Oh, man. So we solve the world problems. That's good.
Yeah. At least at a local level. As long as there's beer and bread and grains involved, we've got it all covered.
I'm telling you, if anybody listening to this, man, you know, this is if you want the solutions, they're right here. Right? We got them.
Just tune in every, you know, episode. Yeah. We're still working that out.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, no, seriously. It's like, you know, we were talking about right before the show today about, you know, how often we're going to do this. And I mean, ideally we could do this every single week. We'll see if we can pull that off. But we're, you know, just know that as listeners to Free Range, that this is a process like anything else. And like, we're going to be changing things up a little bit, bringing in some different kind of models. Who knows? There might be a week we might be two episodes, right? Because we find out that there's a great like a food festival or something going on that we're just going to go on location and talk to them. You know, we talked about going out in Kutztown and sitting down with the folks over at the K-Town Pub, and you know, they're doing some cool stuff with like fantastic barbecue and beer there, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, so which you know from the inside out, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, things like that. So, certainly. Lots of cool stuff.
Is it 3:30?
I'm sorry, what? Yeah, I was just looking at the clock. So, but I was just that was my segue part right there, by the way. Just so if anybody's looking to know what just happened there, that was my segue of me looking at the clock and realizing, oh crap, my daughter's getting off the bus in about 15 minutes. So but before we go, I don't want to kind of give a short shrift. One of the things that we want to do for each episode here is to highlight some of the local farmers, especially those farmers that that Colleen's doing some work with. So take away, Colleen, who we got this week?
This week it is Creaky Tree Farm up in where are they from? They're like 20 minutes. They're 20 minutes north from me. You know, you go down 309 and let me get their address. Anyway, they're up there.
No. As a rule, we will not give you addresses of farms. We will only give you directions about how to get there.
It's 20 minutes north of, you know, the Kempton area. Where are these guys? This one can all be edited out.
Oh, I'm not editing anything.
Where is it?
I'll look them up. Tell us a little about Creaky Tree Farm.
Wait. Oh, damn it. The contact system. God damn it, boys. Right. Creaky Tree Farm is Chris and Alan up in Creaky Tree Farm. They started, I think, about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Their mission is to nurture the earth and our animals as stewards of sustainable living and to grow our community by offering foods that are local, fresh, and delicious. The best from our farm to your table. So they grow, Chris is a gardener, a master gardener. I hope I got that right. And he has one of the most beautiful gardens I've ever seen. And Alan is a chef, and they both raise chickens. They raise a very specific kind of chicken, the breast. It's from the breast region in France, and it's got blue feet, and they're beautiful. They've got these beautiful, like, white feathers, and they're really tasty. They raise chickens, and they have some goats, and there's a couple donkeys, and there's a horse, and there's a really big donkey named Target, who's a French breed that is the most absurdly proportioned animal you will ever see in your life. And they come from the art and food world. If you go to their website, Creaky Tree, that's K-R-E-E-K-Y, treefarm.com. You can read all about them, like with their bios and all that kind of stuff. But they are just awesome. They have this beautiful farm, and it is all about regenerative farming. And Chris, with his gardening skills, and Alan, with his farm background and his chef skills, they have a broad spectrum perspective on what they wanted their home and their farm to be. And their chicken is not just the breast, just the nuggets that they raise are so good. I'll never forget, I think it was like 2 years ago was the first time I ate one of their chickens, something like that. But when I tasted their chicken, it was like I tasted chicken for the first time. It was, and I didn't I have a very specific way that I like to prepare it now, which if you go to my website, look up the decadent chicken roast chicken recipe, you can find it. But it's very specific. But because each of the components within my preparation, I feel bring out the best of what those birds are. But even if it's just salt and pepper in an oven, it is the best chicken. And because of the care that goes into the raising of them, and because of the care that they are butchered in, because Alan does all the butchering, which I wrote a whole post on with pictures and everything, and which I learned then how to butcher chickens, which I realized with that process I could actually do, because it is very sacred. There's an element of sacredness to it that you will definitely not get in a factory farm slaughterhouse.
That's for sure.
So the quality of the care and the processing, you taste, which I think is amazing. And you got to pick up your kids.
I'm like, my mouth is watering here as well. No, I'm just thinking about it. Is that, you know, it's funny because in preparation after we did the promo and kind of did some of the kind of initial recording, trying some stuff out. I, as you know, you were off in Wildwood, right? And I was like trolling your Facebook page and Instagram account.
Down, man.
I was like, oh man, it was like one of the coolest things was, you know, because I've been following you on Instagram and Facebook as you've been posting this stuff over the years since we've been friends, and then. And some of the most vivid and beautiful photos coming out of like when your time you spent at Creaky Tree Farms, like some of the pictures of the eggs, right? And of the chickens, of the donkeys and the goats. Yeah. I mean, it was just
they're beautiful. And you feel different within a space that has that much care, and it's not just an aesthetic. The aesthetic comes from the care that is taken with the land and with the animals. So it's very much something that you feel when you are there. It's not just like, oh, that's pretty and oh, that's cool. It feels different to be in that space.
Awesome. Now all I can think about is like, you know,
chicken and potatoes.
Exactly, which I'm not going to get tonight. I actually barbecued some chicken last night, but it was a rush job, and I was not happy with the way what it came out. And like, I'm, you know, whatever, because we're actually going to see Jenny Lewis tonight. She's up at Music Fest up in Bethlehem. Yeah.
Oh. Have fun.
Yeah, it was my anniversary present, right? but my wife loves Jenny Lewis. I like her too. I mean, she's like, but so we're gonna go see her tonight. So it's more like I get the kids some pizza and then go and get the hell out.
Bye. You're big enough so you don't scream when we leave.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But the one thing I wanted to say is that for everybody, you know, we have a Facebook page up, right? There's not much up there right now, just so you know. It is free range on free range podcast into Facebook. You will come up to the page. All that's there now is a picture and some other stuff. We will be posting the podcast to our Facebook page too as well. We've already got some fans apparently when we posted out the promo. I put it on my Facebook page, on Raging Chicken Press's Facebook page, and we kind of shared it around. So people making comments already. So thank you already to those folks that are out there. And share it with your friends, like this and so on. And the one thing that we had that comment we got from Lou Ryan, actually, who writes for Raging Chicken, who's out in Pittsburgh, she was pretty pissed off not really pissed off, but she was like frustrated that she could not believe that I didn't give up the goods and let everybody know what your Instagram page is after the plug we get. So what is your Instagram page?
Okay, so it sounds like looking at it is nonsensical, but it's MZCCFITZ. And the reason I chose that is because my nickname when I was in high school was Misfit, because it was Ms. Fitzgerald, so it was Misfit. But somebody already fucking took that, so I was like, fuck. So I just added my CCs in it. I'm like, yeah, there you go. So that's what it stands for.
So check her out. That is the place where Colleen posts pictures of the amazing food creations that she's in process of working on, pictures from the farms and everything like this. And like I said in our promo, is like looking at what she's doing on her Instagram page is like eating a meal by itself.
Thank you. Yeah. And if you hit it now, you'll be able to scroll back and see pictures from the most amazing weekend down in Wildwood. It's called the Race of, I have to, because it's fun every year. It's called the Race of Gentlemen, and it's all pre-World War II motorcycles and cars, and they race on the beach, and it is just absolutely gorgeous. Some of the most amazing machines with beautiful details and just elegant designs that you will ever see.
Oh, man. So check it out. So one of the things that we, you know, this is as our inaugural show. This is we hope that that
we hope that you come back.
Yeah, please come back. Please come back, because we love this so much. Right. And I tell you, you know, frankly, we don't really need like a huge audience to have as an excuse to do this. Like, we'll do this anyways. But like, seriously, it's like this is awesome. And we hope that, you know, you're there too. And like, look, as this moves on, we hope that, you know, people, you like our Facebook page. Like for now, we're going to have more information about how to support the podcast in the kind of the coming weeks. And
there's a lot of development going on right now.
Yeah. So it's like we've got, you know, there's lots of stuff, kind of like lots of moving pieces, and trying to say, how do we actually, you know, kind of bring this podcast and into a space where people can get to it easily, right? And can contribute to what we hope can be a community around this too as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yep. If you...
Especially with like net neutrality and stuff getting dead, and with these major mergers that we're having right now, any opportunity to start developing an online community, I think, is going to be essential for our ability to share information.
Yeah.
Because I think I mean, there's no reason not to expect that it's going to get harder and harder.
Exactly. So all the more reasons why we need each other, right? I mean, All the more reason why we should have spaces like this. So so like us, leave comments on here. For now, that
don't fuck yourself. It's fine. You can totally take that out.
No. That's staying in. That's staying in. Oh man. So yeah, so do check it out. Check out Colleen's Instagram, and that is MZCCFITZ, FITZ, on Instagram. And you can look at some of the amazing food that she's, and then next for our next episode, and just, you know, go to our Facebook page. You want to know when our next episode is going to drop. Colleen and I are going to be talking about that, and we'll let you know when it's going to happen. That we're going to spend a little time kind of getting her to preview some of the stuff that she's working on in the kitchen too, because that's where the rubber hits the road, right? In my mind, right? Well, the rubber hits the road is when I get to eat it. When it comes down to it. So hey, thanks all like for tuning in. Colleen, you've got like words for the masses.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you stayed till the end.
There you go. Yes, and
solidarity.
Solidarity, and as the old labor saying goes, bread, yes, but we want roses too.
Preferably candy.
Yeah, well, by roses, I was talking about chocolate roses.
slow baked in the oven with a little bit. You dip them in I can't believe I'm going to do this. So you dip them in egg whites, and you dip them in a little fine sugar, and then you slow bake them at like 200 or I think 200 for a couple hours. My mom did this when I was a kid and we were out in Portland, and the entire house smells up with the smell of roses, and you will never forget it for the rest of your life. You will always remember that smell. I do.
And that is why you listen to the very end of the podcast, everybody.
Look at our recipe.
All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney for Raging Chicken Press.
Colleen Fitzgerald from Home Stony Run.
And this has been the inaugural episode of Free Range. We'll see you soon, everybody.